Luke, what's your walking about?
Last year my football team, we went to a father-son camp out in the woods before the season started.
Nice. Where's it at?
The school?
Yeah.
It's 2.5 hours from here. Towards.
Oh, in Michigan.
Yeah, in Michigan.
Okay. Is that where the campground's near there?
Campground was about an hour from the school.
Okay. All right, good morning, everyone. Let's go ahead and get started 10 seconds early. I'll make sure we make that up at the end. Good. So here we are, Friday. Just completed our first long week of class. And I want to finish up here pretty quickly the question that we have dealing with the ancient Hebrews and trying to figure out what it is that they contribute to Western civilization as we're looking at the larger picture here and trying to find some kind of cohesive narrative of what the Western heritage and Western tradition are. So, as we've talked about, of course, we've seen a number of things as we're trying to ask these great questions of the liberal arts: what is man and what is God? And we've seen thus far that we have a lot of creation, we have a lot of law, we have order to everything. We find that man is both good and bad. So there are a variety of different things and lessons that we're learning from the Hebrews. We also see that God probably doesn't seem, at least according to the story, he's not changing, but the way man understands him is changing, it's diminishing. He's knowing God less and less, and so we finally almost have this kind of outburst. Not really, because God wouldn't have an outburst, but we have this almost outburst where he tells Moses, I am what I am. I am pure being. He is establishing himself in a way that he had not done so or needed to do so with Abraham or with Adam. Now we get to this chapter that's really, you know, partly it's funny because we're looking at scripture here, but we get to this reading that's basically PG-13, you know, bordering on NC-17. And it's pretty amazing to look at what happens here. So I'd like to, and again, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but there are a couple of things that I want you to know. I hope you had a chance to read the story of what's going on with Samuel as he writes this, and then, of course, Saul and David and Nathan, and this rather complicated story. But we find, if we just turn to page 29, with the idea of kingship. Now, remember, we're now much farther. So, Abraham, very long ago. Moses, very long ago. David, very long ago, but they're very long ago from each other as well. So, we've gone forward in time quite a bit here. And we get to the story of what's going to happen with Saul and with David. And we find right at the beginning here on page 29, as Samuel is speaking to God, and they have an interesting relationship. Their relationship is much closer to what it had been with Abraham than it was with Moses, even. And there seems to be a bit of give and take on this. And God says, you don't need a king. Don't do that. You don't need to be a nation like other peoples. You don't want a kingdom. You have a kingdom. You're going to start worshiping false things. You're going to think of politics as religion. Your kings are going to take your sons. They're going to take your sons and throw them into battle. None of these things are good for you. And the Jewish people keep saying, no, we want to be like everybody else. We want a king. And finally, God relents. And he says, all right, but I warned you. This is it. And so there's some very interesting, not only does God, at least according to the story, does he kind of give in to this, but we're going to find that exactly what God says will happen, happens. And everything goes wrong. And so we get, and here are a couple of things I want you to know historically. Obviously, we could get into a lot of theology on this, which we're not going to do. But historically, what becomes so important with this, David, as king, and he is a righteous king for the most part. He is chosen of God, and yet he commits just horrific sins. as king. He abuses his power. He lusts after a woman that he sees showering a few houses away. He then sends her husband into battle to die so that he can be with this woman. And, of course, he is. And then they have their son, Solomon. So it's a fascinating story. And David is never really able to get his life back together after that. He's forgiven. But his family goes wrong. He can't control his own sons. He can't keep his own household in order. Everything just goes horribly wrong. So here's what, and I told you we'd do this rather quickly, and I'm sorry because it's obviously an extremely important and involved story. But for the Western tradition, there are really three things that you have to know about this story and why the story matters for us. And then we're going to conclude the Hebrews and move into the Greeks and look at their contribution to the Western tradition. But here are the three things. It seems to be the case, taking the story rather literally, that power does seem to corrupt even the chosen of God. So power is an extremely difficult thing to handle. It's a very difficult thing to wield. It's a difficult thing to have stewardship over. And even the best of us tend to go wrong pretty quickly. And even after we've gone wrong, even if there's reconciliation, we're broken in some way. That seems to be, I think, a strong lesson that we get here. And it also seems to be the case, I think rather importantly, though obviously if you're coming from a specific Judaic tradition, you might disagree with me rather strongly on this, but it seems pretty clear that the Jews have done best overall when they have not been centralized. The Jews have done best in history. They've survived best when they have not been like other peoples. And as we talked about on day one, they are the single longest-lived people in the history of the world. They have survived hell on earth more than once. And they have not done so because they've been centralized. They've done so because they've been willing to be decentralized and to kind of live out what they need to do and adapt to the cultures where they find themselves. It's not easy by any means. And we'll see when we get to Maccabees and we get to Alexander the Great in probably 2 weeks. We'll see that the Jews are going to have to make very serious decisions about how far are they willing to go to work with the culture. And it's not going to be easy for them at all. And in fact, they'll go into full open revolt. And they do well, but they do well because they get the Romans on their side. But once they get the Romans on their side, the Romans never leave. So it's definitely a trade-off, and that's going to keep happening. So there are lots of lessons we can take from the Jews as a people. Obviously, we can take theological lessons, but we can also take very strong historical lessons from them as well. So when they've centralized, power corrupts like it does everybody else, even the chosen of God. This is a very dangerous thing for us to wield. So we have to be very, very careful about it. The second thing I want you to know about this, so if the first thing is the dangers of politics and centralization, the second lesson we get from the story of kingship with the Hebrews is a more positive one. But it is the idea that there has to be, even in a strained situation, so whether it's strained or not, there has to be some kind of relationship that is explicit, or at least explicitly defined, between the religious power and the temporal power. That is, we don't want religion and politics becoming one, but it's probably pretty healthy for them to recognize the power of one another and more or less to interact with one another. Not in union, but at least in tension. And this will be a lesson, and we are in a time period right now. It's a very strange time period for all kinds of reasons. We're in a weird period of history at the moment. But it has been the norm, and I want to stress this very quickly, and please, you're going to have to dismiss so many myths that we've all been brought up with about the Middle Ages, which most of them are just false, and we'll talk about why that's the case. But we have to be very careful here. The tradition of the West has always been, and the exceptions are important, but they are exceptions. The tradition has always been a separation of church and state. That has been the tradition. The power of the church has resided in one thing, and the power of the state has resided in something else. And they often will go against each other. There will almost always be tension between the two. But the rule has generally been in the Western tradition that we keep those two powers separated. And what we've tried to avoid in the West, and there, we can think and we can list them very quickly. I'm sure you all know. We could list exceptions. Julius Caesar, Augustus Caesar, basically all the Caesars. And then we can go and we can find people like Charlemagne, and we can find Otto, and we can go forward to King Henry VIII. I mean, we're going to find major exceptions here in which the state did everything it could to crush the church or use the church for its own instrument. But those are the reason we remember all of those is because they are exceptions. They do not fit the norm. The norm has always been a separation of Caesar and Pope, or what's often called Caesaropapism. Now, in the East, you don't have that, meaning the Eastern Orthodox Church. In Eastern Christianity, it is very common for the king or the emperor to have a higher role than the head of the church, or to have the head of the church have a higher role than the emperor, or to have some kind of mixing. But in the West, when Jesus says, and I'll actually show you a coin. We actually have one, amazingly enough. Not the coin Jesus used, but the same year, right? We've got the same mint over in the library in our coin collection. And it's fascinating because we all know the famous story of Jesus saying, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's. What we don't get out of that, because it's not explained in Scripture explicitly, when we look at the coin, it's very clear. Because on one side, it has a picture of the emperor, and it says Caesar. And on the other side, it lists another function, pontiff, pope. And so when Jesus actually says, you do have to render to Caesar what is Caesar's, but render to God what is God's, he is, without question, splitting those two roles. They are not meant to be together. And that's very important. And that now, if you're Eastern Orthodox, you might interpret that a little bit differently. So I want you to know I'm coming from a very Western standpoint on this. But from the standpoint of the West, this is a clear division. And that's why we don't see, even in once we have the Reformation, it's only really radical Protestants, like some of the Anabaptists who will give this up very quickly, but only they will kind of flirt with the idea of God and king having the same, or pope and king, or head of the church and king having the same function. So that this has to be very clear that our tradition has been separating those two things. So this is the third point that we get out of Nathan and David, and that is, look at the relationship they have. Nathan, as prophet, has the right and the duty to tell David he's wrong. And that's the relationship it's supposed to be, at least as we've interpreted it in the West. The job of the church, which does not have arms, church is not militarized, it has only the power of the sacraments and the power of religion, and the power of the word, to challenge the power of the state, which has all the power in terms of worldly things. So it always has to be moral conviction against strength, that is, physical strength. And that becomes so. You can imagine David being mad at Nathan, getting rid of him. He just got rid of Uriah. Why not get rid of Nathan? But he doesn't do that. He listens. And that function, whether we want to call Nathan prophet or pope or head of the synod, whatever we want to call him, that role that he has is that role that says his duty is to challenge the state. And that's why you think about, and this is a little bit before your time, and it doesn't matter what your own religious beliefs are, you look at a figure like three popes ago, John Paul II, who was a young man, was in the anti-Nazi underground, and then as a young but still less young man, he was in the anti-communist underground, and then of course he and Reagan almost single-handedly brought the wall down in the 1980s. That challenge that the Pope issued, he didn't have any troops. What's he going to do? Right? But there was a moral conviction there where he could say, no, this is just evil. What you're doing is evil. And it worked. And amazingly enough, it's one of the great moments in all of history, 1989, where the wall comes down without a shot being fired. So there is that conviction. And that has to be there. And of course, it means the church always has to be ready for martyrdom. It's quite often kings don't like to be told, you know, that they're wrong. But that's we're in that situation right now. I mean, we're in the West now where we've secularized so quickly in America in the last 20 years that it's, and this is something, you know, I'll probably be dead before there's anything resolved about this, but in your lifetimes, you're going to be dealing with this question that we are talking about right here, this question of church and state. It will be in that, and war will be the two great questions of your lifetime. So these are things that you really do need to take seriously and think about. I want to add one other thing. This isn't part of my 3 points, but I do want to add this one thing, and this is always a little rough to talk about, but I want you to think about this, especially growing up, you know, being told David's a hero, and it's, you know, as I get older, I become more disgusted with him, and yet I realize, you know, we all make mistakes. My mistakes are different than his, but we all make mistakes, so I don't want to suggest somehow I'm speaking from the point of righteousness by any means, but I also want you to think about this. When Christianity will spread, and it will spread very, very quickly, the only thing that's ever spread as quickly as Christianity is Islam, and they do it in very different ways, but that's future lecture. I want you to think about Christianity spreading. When it spreads, Christianity will not, even though Christianity is deeply Jewish, it will not spread among Jews. So when Christianity begins, in that first 10, 20 years, of course it will spread to Jews, but after that, Jews do not convert in numbers at all. Maybe one or two here or there, but the entire mission field will be pagans. And so this means that, you know, especially think about Paul going to Athens or Peter going to Rome, they're not going to encounter Jews, not many, in those areas. They're going to encounter pagans. And they're going to encounter, which people we haven't talked about yet, but specifically they're going to encounter people called the Stoics, philosophy that we might talk a little bit about today, but it's going to be very important. But regardless, they're going to meet the Stoics. And the Stoics have as their hero, again, I apologize, we're jumping a little ahead, but their hero is Socrates. And Socrates had many of the same teachings as Jesus, yeah, even though he's 400 years, 500 years earlier. Socrates will say, no matter what, even if you must die, you must never do the wrong thing. Basically says, turn the other cheek, no matter what. And Socrates lives it, and he dies a martyr. He preaches what he says, and the state kills him, and he's done. Never in his life did he commit adultery. Never did he send a friend into battle to die. And so when the Christians would go forth and they'd meet the Stoics, Romans, Greeks, and they would say, look, here's Jesus. This is what Jesus is. The Romans would think, yeah, okay, Jesus is pretty, all right, something's going on. We get that. And then they'd say, now let's tell you about some stories that go before Jesus. And here's the story of David. And the Romans are horrified. Like, what? This guy's your hero? He did what to Bathsheba? He did what to Uriah? And you guys like him? Wait a minute. And so they would say, no, we're going to stick with Socrates. He's superior. Our hero's better than yours. It was the story of David was the single greatest stumbling block to getting people to convert in the early church. That's another reason, and I realize, and I apologize, it's probably stepping on the toes of a lot of people in here, but it is hard. Because you put those two guys up, Socrates does come out better. Even if he's not the chosen of God, he looks it. So that's going to be a really tough position for the Christians to be in to defend that story. Okay, so everybody understand that and realize why. All right, any question? I realize it's so abrupt. It's like, okay, the Jews are done. We're going to the Greeks in our drive-by Western heritage. Luke.
Did kings use these passages as like a justification for divine right to rule?
That's a great question, Luke. And I promise you we're going to answer that over the whole semester, but I'll give you a quick response to that. This is where we have to be very, very careful about our images of the Middle Ages. The divine right of kings it wasn't even a phrase until 1528. That was the first time that was... I mean, this is a great question, Luke. It's fantastic, and it's central to the whole semester. But it's 1528, and it's a very prominent English theologian who will actually be executed for saying those words. A guy by the name of William Tyndale. He writes about the need for a divine right of kings. Henry kills him for that, and then he reads his book, and he says, oh, Tyndale was right. I mean, it's a really interesting... So it's not medieval. It's post-medieval. And that's why I caution because yes, they will go back and argue, and especially they'll take Romans 13 and argue there's a divine right to kings because of the, you know, in Romans 13 where God is basically saying, or Paul is saying, you know, all churches and political leaders are appointed by God. There's a lot of debate. That's a very controversial passage, as you can imagine. But that's what they'll kind of, they'll balance that. They'll say, well, here we have God saying you don't really need a king, but he goes along with it. Now you have Paul saying these are all appointed. And it gets very sticky. But so the norm in the West is the opposite of divine right of kings. And again, it happens. And we remember every one of those exceptions. But they are truly exceptions. So we can almost, in a way, looking at 1,000 years of the Middle Ages, it probably looks closer to kind of somewhat organized anarchy than it does, because you may have an emperor, but he's going to last for about 20 years, and then his sons can't keep it together. So they may claim the title of emperor, but it's just not, they can't enforce it. There's no tax system, there's no centralized military, nothing. It's all haphazard. So you've got a lot of, it's not really until you get gunpowder that you can start centralizing things. So, anyway, I'm jumping way ahead, but I hope that helps, Luke, in answering that. Thank you. It's great. Okay, this follows Luke's question as well. And, you know, I told you guys some of the stuff I talk about in here, I'm going to keep going back to Lord of the Rings, and I'm assuming that many of you know the story. But if you remember the story when Aragorn is crowned, it's straight out of Samuel. This is how you crown a king. You know, you have to have the prophet do it. And, of course, they change it a little bit in Lord of the Rings because Frodo, being the priest, gets the crown, and Gandalf, being the prophet, does not. But it's the same story. And even today, you know, when Elizabeth was coronated, the English still use the same ceremony that comes from 1 and 2 Samuel. Every European monarch does. So it's very interesting. Yeah, Mary-Kate.
That's why Napoleon crowning himself was a big deal, too, just because that was the exception, right?
Yes, but he's making fun of the church, right? He's mocking it. So, yeah, absolutely. Any king who crowns himself is totally mocking the church. Yeah, absolutely. They may still be saying they're supporting the church, but they are mocking it. Yeah, that's great. Thank you for that. Good. Anybody else? These are great questions. Excellent. Okay. Well, now we're going to get to the guys that really do help us define, I think, in some ways more than the Jews, because remember, the Jews are an Oriental people who come into the Occident. Now we're going to look at the peoples who first see themselves as Western, and these are the ancient Greeks. And there's a huge, if you've had a chance to look through your textbook, there's obviously a completely fascinating history of the Greeks, from the point that they're in Crete all the way up until, you know, we're in our book where we're basically going to start with Herodotus. So there's a good 1,000 years of Greek history before what we're going to get into here. So I don't want to suggest that somehow the Greeks just showed up. They did migrate into that area. So there were probably 3 migrations of various peoples that became the Greeks to what we call now modern Greece, and what was basically the same, not quite, but basically the same as ancient Greece. And I don't know how many of you had a chance last night to see Victor Davis Hanson, who is, you know, just fabulous in every way. He's a great guy, brilliant thinker, great colleague, great speaker. But he's done the best work, I think, of anybody on what Greece was like in the modern world. And he's done it both at a very scholarly level and an extremely popular level. So I think I mentioned to you, you know, the movie 300 is, no matter how violent and graphic it is, it at least is in part based on Victor's work. So yeah, that's, I think, important. Even, you know, I'm not recommending you see it. It is truly probably the bloodiest movie. It's bloodier than any horror movie I've ever seen. It's as though blood is a part of the screen in that movie. But it's probably pretty realistic on a lot of things as well. Not in the way they show the Persians. The Persians are a little too decadent, but they're pretty bad too, actually. Anyway, so if you see 300, you know, I'll leave that to your own conscience. But I'm not necessarily recommending it. But it is very powerful. So we find that with the ancient Greeks, they do, and what holds them together. And so I'm going to give you a bit of an overview here of their culture, and a little bit of, then we're going to get into what they really argued and come back more to the culture. But the Greeks tended from the very beginning We would never call them a nation. There's no such thing as the Greek nation. They are instead, and they're not even really a republic. It is truly just a culture. These are peoples who speak the same language, generally, but not always, worship the same gods, have the same literary tradition, but they're radically different from one another. So the Greeks are broken down into the area now that's modern Greece, plus a little bit of Turkey and a few other areas. Much of it's underwater now. But ancient Greece is really based on 150 communities. And we don't even have a good term for this. The term that the Greeks would use, which you all have to know, but we cannot translate it into English, we call it a city-state, but that doesn't really work, is the polis. And it's from polis, so that's what you have to know. That's a single one of these communities. And I say it's a city-state, and that's because that's the only thing we can even kind of come close to in English, trying to describe it. It's really much more like, I'm trying to think of a word this, probably closer to, say, a neighborhood association than anything else. Maybe if that neighborhood association had its own security and kind of its own way of thinking, maybe there's a lot of homeschooling going on in that neighborhood association. These are very, very insular. And we're only talking, when we look at ancient Athens, for example, or we look at Corinth or Sparta, we're really talking about just several thousand people. We're not talking about, these are not modern New York or they call them cities, but they're really these communities. And within the community, and this is what I think Victor has shown so beautifully in his own work, Victor Davis Hanson, what he's shown in his own work, is that we, of course, and we do this in this class too, if you take Western civilization, you're going to get a very different, it's not a different story, but it's going to be a more complicated story than what we're going to do in here, because we're looking at the intellectual thought and tradition. But if you took a really good class on ancient Greece, say from Dr. Calvert or Dr. Hanson, you would be looking a lot at the cultural norms, such as farming. And farming is going to be, as you can imagine, the Mediterranean. Anybody here? It doesn't matter if you've been to Morocco or Italy or Greece or, you know, what used to be parts of Yugoslavia. Anybody been to this area of the world, to the Mediterranean? Alexander, do you remember when you go to a home? It doesn't matter if you're in Greece or Italy or North Africa. What happens? This is as true today as it was then. What happens when you go to somebody's home or to their business? Anybody? What is the old traditional greeting?
The homes I went into, they gave us liquor.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, so you probably weren't in a Muslim area.
No.
Okay. So where were you?
Let's see. Not that, actually.
Okay. All right. So was it wine or did they give you? Oh, yeah, you were in a Greek area. Okay. Yeah, all right, which is kind of a schnapps, right? It's similar to schnapps, but much stronger, all right? So like a licorice schnapps. Okay, so you get that. What else? Anything else? They just give you drink? That's usually one half. Then there's something else they must always give you. John? Yeah, but what? Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's food. What food do you get? So like, go to an Italian restaurant. What do they put on your
bread
and olive oil? All right, so this is Mediterranean culture. It is all based around bread, olive oil, and grapes. And you've got to keep this in mind. This is really important. If you live in the Mediterranean, how long can you grow things? What's your growing season? Yeah, basically 9-10 months, right? Sometimes even 12. What about if you live in upper Norway?
A month and a half.
Yes. Maybe. Yes. So, now if you have potatoes, which grow anywhere and without any effort, you can actually get a high caloric intake if you live in upper Norway. Now, where's the potato from?
Underground.
Yes. Originally, where underground? Oh, you're right. It's an American food. There's no potato. There's no tomato in Europe until after Columbus. So what this means, very importantly, is the Greeks and the Romans and all the North Africans can feed themselves. Nobody else can really feed themselves in the West to the same extent. And so imagine, you know, one reason, and I have to be a little bit careful for this, not just because of age, but for other reasons, alcoholism in my own family. But I don't drink a lot, but I do like it. I mean, I'm not by no means a teetotaler. But why is wine both super good for you and also bad? What is it? And it's both. What does wine have? Especially red wine, not white wine, but red wine. What's it high in? It's high in a lot of things. Emma?
Calories.
Yeah. Alcohol is nothing but calories. All alcohol. Beer, wine, spirits. These are very, very high, even if you, you know, you might get something like a Bud Light, but that's not that's not real, right? That's like water with a little taste. When you're talking about real alcohol, it's very, very high calories. Well, do we want a lot of calories in 2016?
No.
Yeah, generally not. But if it's 400 BC, yeah, you take it wherever you can get it, right? That's really good. And so you want as many calories as you can get, and you don't pass food up. Food comes in, you eat it. Well, this is very important because it means that the Mediterranean will develop so much faster than the rest of the West. And it will take the Columbian discovery of America for the North to catch up to the West. We're 2,000 years away at this point from the North having any possibility of being an equal to Southern Europe. And is it, in no way, I'm not a materialist in this way, so it's going to sound stronger than I mean it. But any of you ever wondered why the Protestant Reformation didn't happen earlier? It's not like the church was always great. It's not like it just became corrupt in 1517 and suddenly Luther, somebody had to arise. There'd been corruption, and there'd been goodness too, but there'd been corruption for a very long time. But what kind of revolt are you going to have in the North against the South if you have no food? There is I don't want to suggest Lutheranism comes about because they got the potato. That would be ridiculous. That's not what I'm saying. But it makes Protestantism have a much stronger means of promoting itself if you can actually have kingdoms in the North that can rival the South. It's going to take that long. So once you have, you know, we can't even imagine. How many of us can imagine Irish culture without the potato? And yet, obviously, it didn't even exist prior to 1500. And the same with a tomato. It's hard for us to think about Italian culture without the tomato. There were no tomatoes in Europe or North Africa until after 1500. So all of that is going to change. A huge caloric intake for the North. All right, but to get back to this. So from the origins, and this was true for all the Mediterranean cultures, it doesn't matter if we're talking about olive-skinned people or black-skinned people, this whole area of the ancient Mediterranean was a huge commercial sea, and it was a huge cultural meeting ground for all kinds of peoples. And one of the things we get out of this, and I'm sure those of you who were homeschooled, I did not get this because it was not the trend when I was a kid, but I'm sure many of you have grown up with phonics, learning phonics. And why do we have phonics? Because it comes from the Phoenicians meeting with some other peoples in the Mediterranean, trying to figure out a simple system in which you could learn language and have a trade and actually negotiate with people. And so you think about how easy, really, say, English is to learn versus, say, Chinese. Now, Chinese have different symbols and words for everything. And one reason that happened is because only the wealthy could take the time to learn the language. In the West, you could be the poorest of the poor or the richest of the rich, and you have an equal chance of learning your letters because there are only a certain number of them, depending on where you're at, either 24 or 26. So there they are, and they all mean something. And there's something in them that's quite natural as well that we can come to very easily. But all this is going to be fundamental to the shaping of the Western character. So think about this, and this is why I was asking Alexander about this. But you imagine, you go into a home, and this is still true if you go into a good Italian-American's home or a Greek-American's home. If you've ever seen, you know, My Big Fat Greek Wedding, it's very accurate. It's obviously an exaggeration, but it's very accurate about what Greek culture is like, what Mediterranean culture is like. You go into somebody's home, and the first thing, it's just kind of a moral obligation, you offer them food and drink. You offer them bread. You offer them olive oil, which is of the oils. Where does it rank in terms of calories? It's the highest. It's also the best in terms of, to my mind. There's very few things in the world that smell better than garlic. But again, I'm coming from a certain cultural background. But that matters. And so you have to introduce this. And this from the beginning. Now, when we go back and we look at the ancient gods, and everybody had some form of Zeus within the Mediterranean. But imagine, what is Zeus? He's not just the king of the gods. What is he the patron of? Anyone know? If you've read Homer or you've read any of the great ancient Greek plays, you'll know this. What is Zeus the patron of?
Well, he's the god of lightning, but that isn't the same as but he would be the patron of lightning. So.
Yeah, no, he's a patron of something in particular. He's a patron of travelers. And so if a traveler comes to your home and you do not offer them wine and bread, you have committed a sin. Because Zeus is the patron of all travelers. And so you always welcome even your enemy as Zeus. You have to. You always do that. Now, let's get a little crazy here for a moment. And this is, but you have to know this. What's the Latin for God?
Deus.
Deus. Anybody notice that?
Never before.
No.
It's the same word. And of course, we translate that into English as God. So, when we worship, we basically are worshiping Zeus, but obviously, even as Christians, Zeus isn't Zeus. Zeus is just an image of that. But linguistically, they're basically identical. And we have to keep that in mind. And I want you to think about this. What is today? What's the day?
Friday.
Scott? Why fry? Where's that coming from?
It's Roman, isn't it?
No, it's not. It's a good. It's close. Yeah.
It's either Frigg's Day or Freya.
It's Freya. It's Norse. What's Freya? Who was she? Goddess of love. This is the day you go have babies. I'm not joking. This is the day we bless family. Okay? What about, what's Monday?
Moon.
Yeah? No, it's the moon. That's right. Tuesday?
Q.
Lightning. Wednesday? Odin. Wotan? Odin. Thursday? This one you guys should know, at least from movies. Thor. Now, I want you, just think about that for a moment. Anybody in here worried? Any good Christians in here really worried that we're calling this the day of Freya? Anybody really upset that Zeus is the same word as God? Maybe a little more. But my point is, you know, we transfer this stuff very easily, and culture is not as black and white as it often seems. So, and even, you know, Saturday, Saturn, Sunday, it's not S-O-N, it's S-U-N. That's very intentional. Now, it's also extremely intentional that Christians put the worship of Jesus, the Son, on the Sunday. I mean, that, you know, they do that very intentionally. It's also very intentional that Jesus is born on the 25th. They had it wrong. They thought that was winter solstice. So they put it on winter solstice. It should have been the 21st. But there's no evidence Jesus was born on the 25th of December. That's absurd. It's just the day we pick. Easter, of course, is getting ready for spring. It's vernal. So all of those things, you know, we do this stuff and we take it for granted. Now, it's changing a little bit. I see Protestant churches calling Easter now Resurrection Sunday. Right, and I don't mean to mock anybody, but to me that sounds even more pagan than Easter does. You might as well just call it Easter. But it is interesting that we're starting to think about that. But it also tells us what about Christianity. What does it say about Christianity that we can still call this Friday? What does Christianity do?
We're not really as tyrannical.
Yeah, we're not crazy. We're not going around tearing down temples because they offend us. What do we do when a Christian found a pagan temple? What do we do? They built on top of it. Yeah, that's you. If you go to Assisi,
I've never been there. My mom's described it, and I've seen many pictures. But you go to Assisi, and you look at the basilica there. It's this beautiful medieval basilica built exactly on top of a Roman temple. And it's not as though you look at it and you only see the medieval basilica. The Roman temple is quite obvious. It's the facade. It's the front. And yet, nobody felt weird about that. It wasn't like they said, oh my gosh, we've got to tear this thing down and start over. No. In the same way, there are still 7 great Norwegian pagan churches. And yet, what are they all dedicated to now? Anybody been to Norway and looked at the Stavkirkes? They used to be dedicated to Sigurd, the great patron of the Norse fighting the dragon. Well, who in Christianity fights a dragon?
St. George.
St. George for the English, right? Earlier than that, who who wrestles with who wrestles with the devil?
Gabriel.
Not Gabriel.
Michael.
Well, all those churches now, it's the same church, still a picture of Siegfried, but they're now all dedicated to St. Michael. They just changed the name. And it makes sense when you think about it. So my point, and imagine now we watch ISIS tearing down all these things that offend them. Christians didn't do that. I'm not saying we were perfect by any means, but that's, we're fine with keeping today the day we procreate. And the pagans, that's all right, because no one of us really believes it anymore. And yet, it is significant that we're willing to do that. So one of the great lessons, I think, of the Greeks, and we take this from the Greeks as Christians, it's a very Greek idea, we're willing to accept that there's truth in all things. So when we look at that Stavkirke that was dedicated to a pagan hero, we can say, look, they were doing their best. They had a truth there. It's true that we should defeat these monsters. It just happened to be that they got the good guy wrong. So now we kind of switch the name and we change things around. We don't have to change the hero. We just recognize that hero was only partially in the image of God. Now we make him fully in the image of God. And so this is going to sound really cheesy, and I apologize for this, but I don't think you'll forget it. One of the things we do as Christians, sorry, we obviously speaking from a personal standpoint here, but one of the things Christians do is we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We use the water to baptize the baby. And that's what you have to remember as there's an encounter of various cultures. Now, why do I say this is Greek? Because the Greeks were very easygoing about accepting what they found that was good in other cultures. We do that. Think about my first aid. What do we talk about in the English language? We get a word. It doesn't matter if it's French or from Zimbabwe. It's a good word. We use it. It becomes ours. And I get so upset. Now, I don't know how many of you saw this, but last year, about a year ago exactly, a Canadian university banned yoga because that was a cultural appropriation. It was theft of an Eastern way of life. If we did that, I mean, we wouldn't have any culture at all. Culture is, by definition, a bringing together of ideas. And I don't think people who happen to be white doing yoga are somehow thinking, I'm oppressing the original yoga founders. This is great. And they're thinking, yeah, this was a cool thing. It may have its faults, but it's an interesting thing that we can now use. In the same way, any of this feel really weird? Do we feel like we're oppressing the American Indians when we have a potato? I mean, we would by that definition. We're destroying, we're committing genocide. It's absurd, of course. And yet that's exactly where this argument leads. But the Greeks, and this is why I'm going a roundabout way of doing this, but when the Greeks meet with one another, you can have the Spartans who, I never, ever want to live as a Spartan. You're segregated by gender. They would, if they had babies that they thought weren't going to live up to the standard, they killed them. You know, post-abortion, right? Not even abortion, but afterbirth abortion. They had 2 kings. They had a war king. They had a peace king. It was a republic, kind of, but it was a totally militarized republic. But then you have the Athenians, who, even though the experiment was basically every type of government under the sun, we also kind of remember them for having a democratic moment. It's not a moment, but they have a democratic moment. But then we can look at another community, which actually was an ally, which is ironic, of Sparta.
Corinth would be like Las Vegas for us. Right? Corinth was the, and that's, remember when Paul goes to Corinth, these people are insane. Even the Christians there are just very, it's a port city. It's like going to a naval town. You never expect morality in a naval town. You know, maybe we should, but that's not, you go to Bremerton, Washington, and of course, you know, this is where sailors have been for 6 months, and you can imagine what they want to do when they go on shore. And so that was what Corinth was like. Corinth was basically the libertine city of the ancient world. Total free trade, but free in everything. Sex, everything. Right? This is just completely open society. But their closest allies are the Spartans. They're totally different, but they speak the same language. They have some of the same gods. And they're willing to get along. It's not always easy, but they get along. And this is a very different image than what we're going to see in the East. And so here's where I want to break this down. And we talked about this on day one, but we haven't come back to it. The great difference, as the Greeks defined it, between the Orient and what will be known as the Occident, the West, is that the Occident, the Greeks, believed that freedom was not our modern freedom, the Corinthians kind of was to excess. But overall, the Greek idea of freedom was that I choose my form of government. That's what Greek freedom meant. So I could choose a dictatorship, I could choose a monarchy, I could choose a democracy, and I realize this sounds somewhat contradictory, you know, especially to modern American ears, but that was their idea of freedom. Freedom was the ability to choose your own government, and what this meant versus the Orient, and so hopefully this will take us back to David, and this will be clear why I'm putting all this together, I hope, because I realize it seems like it could just be a ramble, but what happens that the Greeks decide at the same, you know, time that the Jews are figuring this out as well, is that you cannot mix God and king. That is not acceptable. This is the one thing, aside from language, that all the Greeks, no matter what their political form, agree upon. You never give a man the power of God, ever, ever. In no circumstances is this ever allowable. And so this idea is the beginning of the West is the idea that you cannot have a God king. No man has that right to proclaim himself God. He may be a voice of God, and they love Moses, right? Greeks in the pantheon, Moses was a part of the pantheon. They knew of him. He's a great, great lawgiver. He was a demigod to them, superhero, you know, in our modern language. But he was just a man. He was a lawgiver. And that's how the Greeks see this. So there may be a divine element, but the divine element will not rest in one person, and that one person can. So that makes sense for this. I can't stress this enough how important this is. The Occident is born in the idea there cannot be a God king. You cannot have that. And so we didn't get time to get to this today, but I will on Monday. I asked you guys to read the Melian dialogue for today. That little piece of the Persians going back and forth, which may just seem bizarre in all kinds of ways. But I'm taking that from the first great history ever written in the West, Herodotus, just called the Histories. It's not the most creative, but it was for him, because the term was not really around until he made it so. But what do we find in there? We find that, at least as Herodotus describes this, the reason that the Persians hate the Greeks is for all the right reasons. They hate the Greeks, that is from the Greek perspective, they hate the Greeks because the Greeks do not have a real leader. And the Persians don't just want what the Greeks have in terms of resources. Persians are wealthy. They don't need Greece. It's not critical to their existence as a people. Persia's huge. It's modern-day Syria, modern-day Iraq, Iran, much of what's now Turkey. Their empire is absolutely huge. But what offends the Persians is that the Greeks believe they can govern themselves. And that's enough for Xerxes and Darius to expend all the resources of the Persian Empire to destroy the Greeks. And it's that conflict, that incredible conflict with the Persians invading Greece in the early 500s BC, early 400s BC, 5th century BC. It's those invasions that define the Greeks.
So they're not just not Persians. They are also their own people. They don't call themselves Greek, necessarily. They will say they speak Hellas, which is, you know, our version of Greek, our understanding. But they see themselves very differently from one another, and yet they're united against this Oriental idea. So no God king. So if you want to take a theme away from today's class, it's not Freya. That's just kind of trying to make a point. It is, there can't be a united church and state, whether it's the Greeks or the Christians or the Jews. Okay, is that clear for everybody? Right, any final questions? John, I'm sorry, you had your hand up earlier.
Oh, I was just thinking that if Zeus is the patron of travelers, so we have to be nice to them, shouldn't we give all of our stuff to Thebes when they come in to appease Hermes?
Well, it's funny. I mean, we could talk about that. Hermes takes on a different role, right, later on. But, yeah, he's the FTD guy now. Right? He's delivering your flowers. So, thank you, everyone. Have a wonderful weekend. Yeah, just, I would like, yes, thank you. I would like you to read, you have the next two readings, right? You have Herodotus, which I've already assigned, and then you have Thucydides, the Pericles funeral oration. So go ahead and read those for Monday. All right, and have a great weekend, everybody. And Jim, thanks for visiting. Hope you have a safe trip back to Ohio today.
I'm so happy.